You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, Candy won, Candy won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved.
Many storms can form an arch, singly done, singly done. And by union, what we will can be accomplished still. Drops of water turn a mill, singly done, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by United Steelworkers District 11 and Teamsters Joint Council 56. United Steelworkers District 11 represents 33,000 members in the Midwest, protecting worker rights and organizing the unorganized. We support union-made products. Teamsters Joint Council 56 and our nine local unions represent 30,000 workers, retirees, and their families in western Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. We are proud to support the Heartland Labor Forum and their commitment to giving working families a voice in the greater Kansas City community. And we thank our underwriters for their support to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, David Roediger teaches American Studies at KU. He's an expert on the history of the working class in the United States and its peculiar race relations. This week on the Heartland Labor Forum, we'll spend the hour with Roediger and ask him what American management learned from slavery, how racial divisions affect worker solidarity, and what he thinks about KU letting guns on campus. In the news, over 300 march in Johnson County against Kobach and Trump Jr., and ICE says it will start workplace raids again. Our feature at the end of the show is Washington Window on Workers with Mark Grunberg. We'll talk about, of course, the tax fight. Now for the news.
November 30, 2017. On Wednesday, graduate students across the nation demonstrated and struck against a House Republican proposal to tax the tuition waivers grad students receive. Stephen W. Thrasher, a columnist for The Guardian and a doctoral student in American Studies at New York University, wrote in the New York Times, "This proposal represents a serious threat to racial equality. If included in the final tax plan, it would disproportionately harm non-white graduate students and be disastrous for the already dismal diversity of academia, putting an additional roadblock between people of color and the ivory tower and depriving all of us of their desperately needed intellectual contributions. If graduate students were to be taxed on free tuition valued at tens of thousands of dollars, the bulk of their small stipends would have to go to pay tuition tax, rendering doctoral education inaccessible for all but the independently wealthy. Though the Senate tax plan does not appear to include a proposal of this kind, the House plan to tax graduate students would be ruinous. Currently, many universities are quite dependent on grad students to teach classes. There are many reasons why Thrasher says this tax proposal will wipe out students of color from graduate programs, including that they need more degrees to get the same jobs as white graduates, and that their undergraduate student debt is significantly higher than that of white counterparts.
This came in this afternoon from Jobs with Justice. ICE has announced plans to increase workplace raids, and just this week it came out that the agency plans to target a national food service chain in coming weeks. Their strategy will spread fear among workers and bosses alike. While news coverage focuses on the investigation of unscrupulous employers, ICE's new mode of operation is to arrest any workers it finds without proper documentation, meaning that the real goal is clearly to target immigrants. This will likely increase fear and make workers less likely to report abuse on the job, and may also lead to some bosses firing workers out of paranoia, meaning that workers will be affected far beyond whatever specific sites ICE might actually raid. Now is an important time to support workers and to build lines of defense around work sites. Jobs with Justice, the Fight for 15, worker centers, and many unions and community groups, and even elected officials, can help to protect immigrants. Resources exist, like the National Employment Law Project and the National Immigrant Law Center's Employer Guide. That's NILC and NELP. And they have an employer guide on what to do if ICE shows up at a workplace. Employers don't have to let them in without a warrant. There are basic ways bosses can protect workers by asking to see a warrant and knowing what to look for to see if it's really a warrant. Jobs with Justice has a worksite defense toolkit to help you build rapid response teams for if a raid does happen.
On Tuesday, a very diverse group of about 300 protesters gathered deep in Johnson County, Kansas, at a park near the Doubletree Hotel, where Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach was holding a fundraiser for his campaign for governor of Kansas. The celebrity guest was Donald Trump Jr. The crowd, organized by Stand Up KC, Indivisible, and other allies, marched to an intersection near the event and held a spirited rally denouncing Kobach, Trump, for white supremacy and for voter suppression. Meanwhile, a tiny group of 10 white guys perched on a corner across the street with Trump signs and banners. Here's a clip from a speech by Reverend Rodney Williams explaining why the group was there.
We have come to say no to the battle for control of our country, one exemplified by Kobach and Trump in their divide and conquer strategy. Secretary Kobach has made a crusade out of denying people the right to vote. We understand that the right to vote has come through many dangerous roads of sacrifice. And for that reason, any group of politicians that will suppress the vote in any way is engaging against a crime against democracy. So we're here on this evening to work on to build an America with a different identity, one that is inclusive. We are working to build an America that belongs to all of the people, an America that belongs to all of us, blacks and whites and brown immigrants, native-born, LGBTQ, straight men and women, people of all faith, people of no faith. We will fight for an America that believes in multiracial democracy. We will stand together and fight for the heart and the soul of America as long as it takes.
The news tonight was read by Judy Ansel and myself, Michael Savoy.
bright star. Just one voice and one guitar. The will to fight and an open heart. Once again. But now the rain is coming down. Find my luck, run out in one more town. With all the ghosts and the visions, one night of men. I blame the world, I blame the times, but I know some of this is mine. And I hope I'll have time to make amends. So here I am, back at the start. But by now, I'd be a star.
And that was George Mann with I Blame the World. And I guess we can do that. Right now, though, we're going to talk about something a little more specific. I'm Judy Ansel. With me in the studio is Aaron Blackman. Hi, Aaron.
Hi.
Well, when I heard that David Roediger had moved from the University of Illinois to KU to teach in the American Studies Department, I made a mental note to invite him to be on the Heartland Labor Forum, and then I forgot it. But I've always wanted to talk to him about labor history because he is one of the most interesting labor historians, and we're really lucky to have him around this area. So he's here for tonight's show, and welcome to the show, David.
Thank you.
Let me say something about your background. He is a product of a public school education in Illinois. Where in Illinois?
Southern Illinois, a little town called Columbia.
Okay. And then he did his doctorate at Northwestern University in American history?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. His books include Seizing Freedom, Slave Emancipation, and Liberty for All, How Race Survived U.S. History, and With Elizabeth Ashe, The Production of Difference. His older writings on race, immigration, and working class history include The Wages of Whiteness and Working Towards Whiteness. And his most recent book is called Class, Race, and Marxism. And I'm sure there's a few more in there, too. So we're going to talk a lot about slavery and about race and about the divisions in the working class and why it is that the American working class seems to never be able to come together in, very often in solidarity. We want to bring that up to date and talk about the election of Donald Trump and various other issues. So, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to have you. So let me start out by asking you, and also let me say that Aaron is one of our, Aaron is an IBEW apprentice electrician.
Yes, ma'am.
And Aaron is also apprenticing here on the Heartland Labor Forum.
And I've been doing it for a few months now.
Yeah, just for a few months now. And so he's going to help out with this show, which is great.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, that's what we do here. So, David, first off, give us some background on your intellectual interests and why is it that you got so interested in issues of race and class?
Oh, thank you, Judy. First of all, I want to say how delighted I am to be here. I look today, and 15 years ago I was on this show, different host. So I haven't been back for 15 years. And it's good to see you again. It's good to meet you, Aaron. I grew up in southern Illinois in a little town built around a quarry, farm town, but also a quarry. And it was what people in the Midwest call a sundown town, meaning that African Americans had to be out of town by sundown, at least according to the police. If there were a law or not is another question, but so I grew up in that setting. But in the summers, my mom was from a town right at the southern tip of Illinois called Cairo, And Caro was the host to this incredible Black Freedom Movement in the middle to the late 60s. And I was lucky enough to be there. So Caro at that time was 15,000 people, half black, half white. And in the summers, I went there, and I was raised Catholic, made to go to church. And I kind of figured out that the black little mission, black church in town, said Mass in about 20 minutes. And so my initial impulse when I was 12 was to say, I'm going to go to church there. It's faster than the Irish church. And it turned out to be the hub. The reason they got through the church service so fast was it then became a place of political education for the Black Freedom Movement. So I was growing up in these two extraordinarily racist settings. Caro also had this huge white hat, fight back, armed resistance to integration. And then the sundown town, but they weren't anything alike. They were both really white supremacist in their attitude, but one with no black people in the experience of anybody, and the other with this vibrant freedom movement going on. And so, you know, I didn't at that time say, I've got to figure this out. But what I did do was, I think, kind of file that and say, well, race isn't simple. Even white supremacy isn't simple. There's a lot to understand in it and to figure out about it. Mm-hmm. And then later, as I was part of the New Left and the anti-war movement and the Black Freedom movement, it became possible for me to kind of act on these things and study these things. I also come from a trade union family on kind of all sides, skilled workers. My mom was a teachers union leader. So I had, and not so much, except for my mother, were any of those people anti-racist. But I had that kind of in my background that you took collective action and you kind of thought these things through together.
Hmm. Well,
I can actually kind of attest that myself, just for some fact that I'm from Biloxi, Mississippi. And after I graduated high school up here and went back to the University of Southern Mississippi for 2 years, and upon speaking to certain friends of mine, they have had experience with those sundown towns, like you said. Yeah. One of them actually told me a story when I first got there about an experience. He was on his way to a friend's house, and he had to pass through said town, and it was right at dusk.
Yeah,
and he actually got pulled over in a nice, not so nice manner. The policeman told him, "Well, you got 20 or so minutes to get out of town, or I'm not going to be responsible for what's going to happen to you." Yeah. So, you know, when you still have illustrations like that, still in 2017,
yeah,
you know, that is where the lines of, you know, talking about history and how it pertains to the present, you know, that's where those lines need to be put together, connected. So brought that to mind.
After the election, a graduate student and I wanted to try to figure out the race and the Wisconsin vote. Wisconsin was one of the states that Trump kind of surprisingly
won.
And so to get at the white vote in Wisconsin, we decided to look at every county where the county seat was a sundown town. And because it's hard to get city data.
Wisconsin had sundown towns?
Wisconsin, most towns were sundown towns. Wow. So even now, 72 counties, the thing that most surprised us about the study we did was 58 of the 72 had county seats that were sundown towns. And you could say that they elected Trump. They gave about a 80 or 90,000 vote majority to Trump. Strangely, they had voted for Obama in 2008, and they were exactly those kind of rural counties where people, on one hand, realize they need change and need a strong state if they're going to survive, but on the other hand, are kind of tempted by xenophobia and racism.
Uh-huh.
Definitely.
Yeah, it's a lot more complicated than
it is complicated.
Simply just, you know, racism, for sure. But, and I want to come back to that. But first, I want us to delve into the history a little bit.
Sure.
So that we can, you know, sort of have some common frame of reference to talk about these issues. So your first book is called The Wages of Whiteness. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Well, it's a riff on W.E.B. Du Bois, the great African-American historian, who talked about white workers after the Civil War as not being paid very much in general, but says they also accrued a, what he calls a public and psychological wage. So this idea that no matter how low you are, you can say that as a group you're better than another group. Du Bois called that public and psychological wage of whiteness. And I just, for title purposes, to make it a little bit neater and to kind of riff off Wages of Sin and to imply how what a bad bargain those wages actually were, I ended up calling that book Wages of Whiteness.
But, okay, so what I remember from that book, it's been years since I read it, was that you spent quite a bit of time talking about how white workers had this propensity to try to always want to distinguish themselves from African Americans and from black workers, and that division was really sort of in our blood or in you know deep into our history.
Think exactly in our history. The United States is the only country in the world that took off toward industrialization, really had a working class of significant numbers while it had millions of people enslaved. So the foundational experience for the working class was that you could always say, and you wouldn't be wrong, yeah, this is miserable. Yeah, wage slavery is terrible, but it's different from black slavery. And I, as a white worker, am different from enslaved black people. And so it is very much kind of hardwired into the history of the United States that you have this coincidence of mass slavery and industrialization, the first growth of a working class.
One of the examples I remember from that book that really caught my attention was your discussion of the origins of the word boss. And that because the previous term was master. And after the revolution, white workers are very intent on distinguishing their bosses from masters.
Yeah. And so they pick up this Dutch term, which just means master. But they were able to not say master. So these European travelers would come to the United States and they'd visit a home. They'd knock on the door and the servant would come up and they'd say, "Is your master home?" And they'd get a little lecture from the working person saying, "I don't have a master." And the solution to that then was for workers to start calling their employer their boss.
Just as easy as it is to see that they were distinguishing themselves, there are also people that, as far as the bosses are concerned, that would use their positions to their advantage in order to gain more of an advantage. And Lyndon Johnson has a claim. There's a claim that Lyndon Johnson had a quote that if you give the poorest white man a reason to look down upon somebody else, that he'll empty his pockets for you, and essentially that they will, you know, that somehow some way that they will see themselves better, even at their lowest point, better than the best black person. If you know you can speak more into how that plays into the workplace.
That's what that public and psychological wage is, that you don't have to give people much in the way of wages if you're giving them these honors, these petty privileges. A lot of it is has been historically articulated through masculinity, that, you know, that this kind of recognition of white manhood by the boss becomes a way that people can talk to each other and can imagine that they have something in common that transcends class interests, this kind of white manhood.
And you actually, in your book, that I'm currently reading, Seizing Freedom, you actually speak to, especially to that, as far as how people were actually, eventually after Reconstruction, trying to find a way of defining themselves other than the white manhood that determined how the pot stirred. That determined how everything was going to flow, and how blacks trying to find identity for themselves within their specific movement, the women's rights movements, how that bred into the labor movements, worked toward 8-hour days and all that. Man, I think that that gets glossed over. Quite a bit as far as what the place that masculinity plays into that.
Thank you. I mean, I think that one reason that Reconstruction was such a glorious possibility, a period of possibility, was that you couldn't really think in the same way that I'm automatically, as a white man, above every black person. You've seen 4 million people become freed overnight. And so this idea that, well, I'm not a slave, I'm not black and I'm not a slave. And then two, probably about 800,000 white soldiers were disabled by the Civil War. And so that kind of mass experience of disability kind of cut through the idea that this could be a system that's based on the able-bodied white man being able to run the government, to run the household, to run the economy. All of that gets put into very sharp question, at least for a little while, in Reconstruction.
I must admit, just while you know, I have the opportunities, I really do and really did enjoy the fact that you described the slave rebellion as the first general strike in this country.
Which slave rebellion was this?
I can't remember exactly.
So the period during the Civil War, about 800,000 enslaved people find their way to the Union Army, and that motion, literally just walking around toward freedom, Du Bois actually coined that term, and he called it the general strike of the slaves, which is a very challenging notion to make. It challenges how we think about general strikes, which I think we sometimes think that they're formal and unions call them and they last for a certain number of hours. And, you know, but in fact, Du Bois says, no, this is a 4-year-long mass movement. And then importantly, he said, it's not just the people who left the plantation, but it's people who stayed on the plantation and didn't obey management during the war and put the slaveholding class on the defensive, even though they didn't escape. He said they too were part of the general strike of the slaves.
Yeah. Well, of course, I think, you know, one of the things that the standard notion of American history ignores tremendously was the role of slaves and the role of the black emancipation movement in actually bringing down slavery. I mean, you know, it's the credit is mostly given to the politicians and the white guys and the white abolitionists as opposed to those slaves who actually resisted. And both passively and actively.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's really important to understand that was a movement.
Yeah.
Of workers.
One of my former students, Taya Miles, who's this brilliant historian of Michigan, now has a book on slavery in Detroit, in and around Detroit, in early Detroit. And we don't think of Michigan as a slave-holding area, but for a long time, there were plantations in Michigan, and a lot of the infrastructure was built by enslaved people. And what's really great about her book, which is called The Dawn of Detroit, is that it ends with the slaves ending slavery. She talks about how enslaved people just made it impossible in that situation, often by escaping to Canada and to freedom. So, I think that the best histories of slavery then are also histories of emancipation at the same time.
Yeah, I know one of my favorite books was Vincent Harding's book.
Oh, yeah,
There's
so
a
good.
River. That's a wonderful book.
It is really, really good. I got to meet him toward the end of his life, and he was also a great person.
Yeah. So we're going to take a break. We're talking to David Roediger, historian, and I'm Judy Yancel. With me is Aaron Blackman. And we're going to take a break for a couple of announcements, and then we'll be back.
As fracking operations in Oklahoma and Kansas have increased, so have earthquakes. And now fracking operations are beginning to encroach upon the KKFI listening area. Hear the latest on fracking on Eco Radio KC, Monday at 6 p.m.
Did you know underwriting KKFI's program spreads the word about your organization or event and supports KKFI at the same time? Learn more at kkfi.org/underwriting. Okay. All right. We're back. I'm Judy Yancel, and co-hosting is Aaron Blackman, and we're talking to Professor David Roediger, who's in American Studies at University of Kansas in Lawrence.
And you've been there for 4 years, right?
Yeah, this is my fourth year.
Yeah, and before that you were in Illinois, and then you before that you were in Minnesota?
And Missouri, when I first met you in connection with your labor education program, I was at Missouri.
Yeah. I'll never forget, you illustrated a curriculum thing that I've actually used, and it was something where you asked people to pick what date the labor movement started to decline.
Mm-hmm.
And you gave them 1948, which was Taft-Hartley, and I think 1955, which was the merger of the AFL and the CIO.
Yeah.
And 1971, which was the first oil crisis and Nixon going off the gold standard, and 1981, which was Reagan.
Yeah.
Right. And then you asked people to talk about which they thought really brought the labor movement down the most. It was a great question.
Huh.
Yeah.
Thanks.
And I've used it. Yeah.
Thanks.
So what was your answer?
Young people now have other ones that they've seen even more decline.
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's Bush, there's Trump. Yeah. Never ending.
I have this T-shirt that says, end a generation of givebacks. Mm. And since then, there have been three generations of givebacks, actually. So, yeah.
That's true. So, okay, so I want to talk some about the writings you've done about management. And you have this book called Producing Difference?
Production of Difference.
It's a weird title, but anyway. And you started out with this wonderful cartoon from the IWW. It's a Mr. Black cartoon.
Yeah.
You want to talk about it and why it's important?
Yeah, the cartoon is called Mr. Black, He Meets Others. So Mr. Black is this character drawn by a worker in Minneapolis who has a square block-like head. And
he's a blockhead, right?
Yeah, he's a blockhead. And because of that, he can't get class consciousness. So he keeps coming back to faith in the system, faith in the police, faith in the labor contractor, faith in the boss. And he's always drawn as a block, but presumed to be white. And Ernest Reby, who drew it, was a white worker. But in this one, Block is all different colors and nationalities. So he's Japanese, he's Italian, he's black, he's German, and in each case...
He's even Chinese.
And in each case, he's being bossed by a white boss in a kind of a suit that might be a cheap suit, or it might be a fancy suit, but he stands in for capital, and he especially stands in for management. And he keeps going around from one racialized Mr. Block to another, saying, hey, if it's a black worker, you better watch out for those Chinese, and playing into the stereotypes connected with every group. So he's talking about the next group's stereotype to the group that he's trying to get over with. And then at the very end, he's able to just lounge, and his management task is done,
and
everybody else is just working away as hard as they can, and in the cartoon, sweat is flying off of them. So, yeah, it's a kind of a nice cartoon about divide and conquer.
Right, exactly. And, you know, we see it today, and we've seen it throughout our history. I worked in a factory in Kansas City, Kansas, back in the late 70s and early 80s, and you know, I watch management do that all the time, pitting. You know, we had separate seniority lists between the white workers and the black workers, which was ended sometime in the early 70s by the government. You know, and the black workers got to work in the foundry, and the white workers got to work in the machine shop.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, everybody thought that, like the white workers thought, well, the black workers weren't capable of working in a machine shop. And lo and behold, when they merged the seniority lists, you know, they found out that they could, and then we had the same issues with women.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And I had to grieve getting on a machine because they didn't think I could do it. And so, yeah, it just happened all the time. And Aaron, it still happens, right?
Well, yeah, it does happen, but it's a lot more subtle now. And you would think that certain legislation that has been put out there as far as the affirmative action things out there, the people don't understand there are slippery slopes with that also, because you know, case in point, with affirmative action, you have two people going into an office, and just so happens the black person isn't as qualified. It's just as easy for that person to get hired on, not qualified, end up failing at that job miserably, and that the employer now has 5 years of census information on his books that he doesn't have to employ another black worker.
Mm-hmm. Great.
That's one of the subtleties of the inherent, you know, some of the racist actions within that happens within the workplaces, within out in the world, period.
Yeah.
And you know, like I said, you would think legislation would help along with that, but in some ways it's created more loopholes for more stuff to happen.
Yeah.
for management to manipulate the situation even more so than it could before.
So let me ask you, you know, I've always suspected that the particular propensity of American management to divide workers by race and ethnic group and gender goes back to slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And turns out you wrote a book about this.
Yeah, Production of Difference is really about, on one level, the origins of U.S. management in slavery.
Uh-huh.
So, and playing off enslaved workers against free workers, and for a certain time, playing off different African nationalities against each other, so that you would say, oh, they're, the Ashantis on this plantation are getting an edge over some other African ethnic group. So I think history of management has generally started in about 1880 when people write histories of management.
Right. Well, or with Taylor.
Yeah, or with Taylor, which is just a little later.
Or with Willie Lynch.
Okay, yeah. So that's the idea that you would go back and include this earlier history of slavery as a managerial strategy. And it turns out that there were tons of journals, business, professional, managerial journals. The first journals of management in the United States are not from the post-Civil War period. The slaveholders had their own journals, and they were very often about how do you manage enslaved labor. And they had, you know, charts to encode productivity and to try to figure out under what conditions productivity was optimized for enslaved workers. They thought about trade-offs between physical brutality and incentives. They had all of the kind of hallmarks of a managerial system existed in slavery. And then what Betsy Esch and I argue is that those habits kind of continue in the post-Civil War period, but now the groups being managed might be Northern Italians versus Southern Italians versus Yugoslavian workers versus Greek workers, all of whom at that time in the around 1900 were thought of as separate races. Mm-hmm. Even Northern Italians and Southern Italians were thought of as separate races. So one great pioneering labor historian says that the only symptom of originality in U.S. management is to play one race against another. He was writing about World War One. He thought race meant all these different European nationalities, and in particular being able to play the poor people of Southern and Eastern Europe who were coming in against each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's so many ways that can play out. You know, like you said, it goes beyond just color, color division, you know, age, gender, you know, whether, you know, somebody, you know, walks or talks a certain way. There's just so many ways of division. So, I definitely agree with you on that as far as just how far-reaching it definitely can be.
So how do you know that management theory that was developed under slavery was actually copied by, like, industrial managers or railroad managers?
Well, you can see it in certain things in the South. You can see that certain managers, particularly in iron,
iron foundries,
and then later steel. Uh-huh. But you can see those continuities. Some of them are just a kind of a general approach to what kind of a nation. One of the things we argue is that the peculiarities of the United States make white people believe that they have a certain role in management. So we use this phrase whiteness as management.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot in U.S. history that makes white people believe that they're particularly suited to manage, not necessarily labor, but even to manage land. So the whole settler project,
right. The
in
whole
the
Indian
United
thing,
States
right?
is about. Well, why do you have that right to that land? Well, because we know how to manage it better as whites. We know how to, the really interesting word that people used at the time, we know how to husband that land better than other races, than the people who actually live on the land.
Yeah, I wonder what Mother Earth has to say about that.
Yeah, it's a great verb.
I think that thought process really does go crawl, because it's developed in a way, because at first you could say that it is mainly, it's generalized with Caucasians. Mm-hmm. But now, be as though there has been some kind of progress made toward, you know, wealth being a little, just a little more,
right.
a little more marginalized, but it goes to just a position of power, mm-hmm. because those of who have been whether you're white, black, or whatever, you know, you can still say and act in the same manner as your counterparts just because you have that certain thought process.
Yeah,
you get there and you get the taste of it, and now, for whatever reason, you feel like you're godlike. You get the God complex.
Yeah. And you might not even have anything yet. I mean, one of the things that I notice about in Kansas is that there's this kind of cult of the entrepreneur. You know, Brownback had entrepreneurs not paying taxes because they supposedly create all jobs.
Right? Yeah, we see how that happened. Yeah. See how that worked
right.
out.
I think about one person in 14 in the United States is an entrepreneur, in the labor force in the United States is an right. entrepreneur. But they have this mysticism that surrounds them that makes a lot of other people think, well, maybe I'll get a franchise someday, and
right,
maybe
right.
I'll own a car wash or something. And so
I want to be my own boss.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's
of course.
Part of it.
Yeah.
So let's get back to, we only have a few more minutes, and I want to get back to the present.
Okay.
Not that we just didn't get there. So you know, what do we learn? What should American workers learn from this whole history of division and of being pitted against each other? I mean, or why don't we learn?
Yeah,
you know, something about common interests. There's this common way of thinking these days in the labor movement, which is that too many white workers vote against their own self-interest.
Right.
You know, I'm not sure that's a good way, a very useful way of putting it, actually, because obviously they conceive of their self-interest differently.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what do we learn from this history? What should we learn?
You surely knew Jerry Tucker.
Yes,
I
did. The
great Auto New Directions leader in St. Yeah. Louis. The last meal I had with Jerry, died, I guess, about 3 years ago, something
yeah.
like that. Now, the thing he wanted to talk about was Paul Ryan. And he said, you know, that's the thing that the leadership of the UAW is going to have to answer for someday, is they gave us Paul Ryan. And what he meant was, Paul Ryan lives in, represents Janesville,
right.
the center of union power in Wisconsin. But people never really, Janesville's a sundown town, by the way. It's not quite anymore, but it was. They never were able to break through and crush Ryan in that setting. It was partly because there were other smaller towns that he had a lot of support in, but he also had some support, Jerry thought, among auto workers mm-hmm. who maybe had a cabin and you know, by working 75 hours a week and not really getting to enjoy the cabin, they were able to buy a cabin in addition to their house, and so mm-hmm. they thought of themselves as being in a different position than poorer working people. And to a certain extent, they were in a different position because they had that little extra piece of mm-hmm. Of property. But he talked, and I don't think I'll ever forget this conversation, because he so understood how things that, you know, maybe are rational in a certain way are completely self-defeating in another way. And, you know, I think what we've seen out of that strategy is kind of the end of the good working class job in so much of the United States now. This production of difference, when we wrote Production of Difference, we were thinking about this town near University of Illinois called Beardstown, another sundown town, that had been a tremendously important meat processing place. Oscar Mayer had a big factory there. So those jobs were all reserved for white workers. It was unionized, but Jim Crow. And then when Oscar Mayer threatened to go out of business, they kept the plant by giving it to Cargill. But the union had to give up so that a time and a half as many animals were killed every day on the same assembly line. So the line speed just increased by 50%. They then couldn't get local workers to do that work because local workers realized that they were getting carpal tunnel and that it was the most dangerous job in the United States for a while was meat packing. So they now, this formerly sundown town, has 30 languages spoken in its grade school. It's still a union, but a union where people make $11 an hour.
As opposed to what they were before.
Well, and are working half again as hard. So, you know, that I think is the end. And maybe for the, you know, white workers who maybe retired and took disability, maybe that didn't seem like such a bad deal. But for the working class as a whole, this is just a kind of terrible set of circumstances when we keep falling for this kind of a tactic.
It definitely sounds like it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what about Trump and Trump's election? Is it the same thing? Is it just people who fall for the wrong tactics?
I think that's a part of it. I think the harder thing to say is, I think that we usually think about whiteness and voting, whiteness conservatism and voting when people make a choice like half of workers vote for Reagan, even though he's just destroyed Patco, are in this case half of people, 45% of, I think, union households vote for Trump. And that's part of it. It does make for bad choices in that counterproductive even in one's own interest. But the other part of it is that even when it's not an election like that, whiteness functions in the United States to make the Democratic Party present less to vote for working people. So I think that, you know... For example... During this election, after this election, a lot of news people would go to Harlan County or some formerly union, now desperately poor area in Kentucky.
Someplace where they'd blown up the mountain in order to get the rest of the coal out.
Right. Yeah. And they'd find workers, really unemployed workers, who had voted for Trump and now had lost Obama or were threatened with losing Obamacare. Mm-hmm. And the idea we were supposed to think and realize that this was a foolish choice. But, you know, a further thing you could say is, why is it that it's only Obamacare that they have to tie them to the Democratic Party? What if we actually had free health care? What if we had a set of social democratic reforms?
So you're saying that white voters limit Democratic Party is willing to go for?
When people vote on the basis of whiteness, and the Democratic Party, I think, often plays into this, welfare then becomes something that's associated with people of color. Food stamps get associated with people of color. So you don't necessarily get a full kind of social democracy in the Democratic Party. It's always constrained by race.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, 2 minutes left. Talk to us about guns on campus and why you're so interested in that issue.
Well, it's not the kind of issue that one can handle in 2 minutes, but thanks for asking me. The thing that I think was really eye-opening, two things that were really eye-opening for me in the Kansas gun struggle, which we failed to keep concealed carry weapons off of campus. One was how really powerful the NRA is in conservative politics in Kansas, and what a tremendous role just that one organization plays.
Okay, good. I'm going to put you on hold.
But the okay, the other was that.
Lost your train of thought. How powerful the NRA was?
How powerful the NRA? Oh, and the other is how hesitant universities are to support free speech. One of the things in the law in Kansas has been that state workers can't speak either for or against guns. And you know, this was a workplace issue about safety. And
I didn't
about,
know that.
And so they were able to introduce this idea that this was to speak against guns is somehow lobbying. So the collective action of workers on the campus was constrained by this law, and the university administration never said, no, we're going to challenge this. This is obviously unconstitutional. They kept saying, watch yourself. You know, it's against the law to protest. It's against the law to have an opinion about these things. And it was a really terrible thing and demoralizing thing for campus workers to kind of be told, you can't, as workers,
yes,
speak about this issue.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, there was just an article in the paper today, too, about how I think it's CanCare workers have been gagged and told that they can't talk to their state reps about the conditions in their workplaces.
Yeah.
You know, this is scary.
Yeah.
You know. Well, thank you very much. We've been talking to David Roediger. And thank you, Aaron, for doing a great job.
Once again, I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
And in just a minute, we're going to be doing Washington Window on Workers with Mark Grunberg. And stick around.
Great. Okay.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel again, and with me on the phone from D.C. is Mark Grunberg. You there, Mark?
Yeah, I'm here. I wish everybody else could hear the first half of your show as well. That what I caught sounded very interesting.
Well, glad you liked it. I'm glad you liked it.
Including workers' freedom of speech being curtailed, which is unconstitutional, as they were saying.
Right.
Sheesh.
Right. Anyway, so you wanted to talk about taxes. I don't know why. Nobody else is doing that.
God. Yeah. Where do you want to start? Basically, if you are a middle class taxpayer or a poor taxpayer and the Senate passes this bill, whatever it will be, sometime tonight or maybe in the wee hours of tomorrow morning, and the House goes along, and it might or it might not, but it might, your taxes will go up.
Yeah.
Let me repeat that.
Right. No matter what the president says, right? They're going up.
Right.
Yeah.
They're going up, not down. If you are Warren Buffett or Jeff Bezos or Donald Trump, your taxes will go down,
mm-hmm,
in so many words.
So, you know, something like, I guess it's the top 1% are really going to clean up, but even the top 10%
are going to clean up, yes,
right.
Exactly.
Right.
And let's not forget a few other goodies in this thing. 13 million people might have to drop their health insurance. This is in the Senate version of the bill, because all of a sudden, the insurance companies are going to have to raise the premiums 10% to cover all the people who won't be covered because they're yanking back the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, right.
That's another part of it. Right.
So let me ask you this.
We could go on and on and on and on, but we have only 10 minutes.
Well, actually, we have 5. So let me ask you this. Is it going to pass?
As of right now, this minute, the answer is it looks like it's going to be a 50-50 tie, and then Pence breaks the tie.
So who are the senators who are on the fence? I heard that Jerry Moran from Kansas was one of those people who was asking questions, which is surprising.
Yeah, which is surprising. Well, Ron Johnson was even more surprising, the guy from Wisconsin.
Right.
But then all of a sudden you get two of the people who voted against the GOP's health care bill saying they're now going to vote for this thing, McCain and Murkowski.
Jeez.
So you have Johnson and Moran balanced off against McCain and Murkowski, and you still have a couple of people on the fence who haven't come down one way or the other, and probably won't till about midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning. So,
okay.
That's where we are.
In your article this week, you talk about Chris Shelton from communications workers being very, very outspoken. What did he do?
Well, what he did was he took Trump's promise. Trump was in Philadelphia. The president was in Philadelphia about 2 weeks ago and said, this tax cut will give your average middle-income family $4,000 extra in their pocket every year. So Chris Shelton, who is from New Jersey, actually he's from Brooklyn, but CWA has a lot of people in Jersey and Philadelphia, wrote to the CEOs of each of their big corporations whom CWA represents and says, okay, since you guys are going to get a benefit from this thing, put it as an extra contract provision. $4,000 in everybody's pocket starting next year.
Right.
He set a deadline for tomorrow for replies. I think we can safely say he's going to get none. So,
well, you know, that'd be an interesting proposal. That'd be an interesting proposal at the bargaining table. right now, I'd like to ask every one of these senators how many of them have actually read the bill, and I would bet zero. They don't even know what they're voting for. It's a pig in a poke.
Very much a pig in a poke.
Well, thanks for keeping us informed, Mark, and we'll talk to you next month.
Right. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
And like we said, a pig in a poke and an editorial, and we're all getting the pigs are at the trough.
Right. Well, you know, and next week you can next month maybe you can tell us a little more about what's in the trough. Since nobody seems to know right now.
Right.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Talk to you later.
And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar, which is a little bit short. Tomorrow, Friday, December 1st, Empower Missouri is having its first Friday lunch, and it's about the 2018 policy options that promote equity, I assume, in the Missouri legislature. And this is at 11:30 and for lunch, 12 o'clock for the program at the Westport Flea Market Bar and Grill, 817 Westport Road. And enter from the back. It's in the Buffalo Room. Jobs with Justices monthly meeting is next Tuesday, December 5th at 6:30 p.m. at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church at 4501 Walnut. And on Thursday, this may be a little late, there's a rally against the tax bill at 12 noon at Senator Blunt's office, 1000 Walnut Street, Kansas City, Missouri. And this is sponsored by the communications workers. And finally, Jobs with Justice's annual Scrooge of the Year party is Thursday, December 14th from 5:30 to 7:30 at IBEW Local 124, 301 East 103rd Terrace. And we will put a link on where you can vote for Scrooge. There's a number of Scrooge candidates that have been nominated by Jobs with Justice's member organizations, including Donald Trump, what a surprise, Chris Kobach, Eric Greitens, and some guy from Cass County, and I can't remember his name, who the firefighters nominated. And we'll put a link to that so you can find out who you want to support for Scrooge. They sell votes. That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week. And the show is going to be about two books. One is Politics of the Pantry, Housewives, Food, and Consumer Activism in the 20th Century. And a book called Sowing Hope, about the Alta Gracia factory in the Dominican Republic, which proves that you can pay good wages and have a union in a third world country. That's it for tonight. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Lincoln Dreyer, and stay tuned for the Thursday night special.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI.